Can architects and designers shape an intelligent, resilient and sustainable future?
Design Perspectives, the podcast of the German Design Council. Today with host Martin Pauli.
Welcome to this new episode of Design Perspectives, a podcast format of the German Design Council. My name is Martin Pauli. This is a special episode as it puts the upcoming Architecture Biennale in Venice in the focus, and I'm beyond excited to have the current curator with me today. Carlo Ratti is a renowned architect, engineer, and academic, serving as a professor at the MIT, where he directs the Sensible Cities Lab. His work explores the intersection of architecture, urban planning, and digital technologies, aiming to create a smarter and more sustainable city. Carlo has been a pivotal figure in urban innovation, contributing to projects such as the Future of Food District Pavilion for the 2015 World Expo in Milan, and serving as a special advisor on the urban innovation to the European Commission. As the current curator of the Venice Architecture Biennale, Carlo continues to push the boundaries of architecture, thought, and practice. So welcome, Carlo.
Thank you for having me.
Carlo, this year's theme is intelligence. Natural, artificial, and collective. Can you maybe explain us what the reason behind that is?
Yeah, thank you. No, thank you for asking. Today, when we talk about intelligence, everybody starts thinking about AI, about artificial intelligence, or even in a narrower way to ChatGPT and so on. And I thought it was important to see how architecture actually has been able to leverage many different forms of intelligence. I think, you know, you mentioned intelligence. We spell it here. We've been using the common root in Latin, intelligence, which has this kind of idea of gens or gens, multiplicity, in a different type of intelligence. And so natural artificial collective is a way to explore not only technology, but also some of the amazing forces coming from nature, coming from, again, learning from each other in the collective that have been helping us to shape the built environment over thousands of years. And we think that this is very important, especially today, when we need to face adaptation to a changing world.
Why did you feel the need now to make that the central theme of the Biennale? What's the kind of the opportunity that you see in the current world?
I would say probably two of them. You know, at the very beginning, one of the ideas was, you know, maybe we should call the Biennale NI, natural intelligence, as a point, you know, to make the point that there's much more than the narrow focus we are talking about today when we talk about intelligence and only AI, artificial intelligence. But then again, we went into this direction of a more inclusive approach to different type of intelligence. And the second reason, going back to your question, is that architecture has been engaging with the climate for a long time. Think about in the 1990s, Richard Rogers, the great British architect, wrote a beautiful book called Cities for a Small Planet. You know, at the end of the same decade, there was a big manifesto signed by many architects at the time about better using solar energy and better using renewable energy in architecture. And that kind of approach, in terms of mitigation, was about making the built environment more sustainable. And that is still very, very important. But at the same time, it is clear now that we also need to look at adaptation. Now, when we look at over the past few weeks at what happened in Los Angeles with the fires, what happened in Valencia or in Bangladesh with the floods, you know, what's happening in Sicily with drought, you know, when you look at all of that, then we certainly need to take action in order to adapt our built environment. And so that's the second reason. I would say, you know, even with what's happening in some parts of the world where, you know, fossil fuels are being ideas such as drill, baby drill, or, you know, pushing against fossil fuels, well, then adaptation becomes more and more important. So how we can adapt to a different context and how we can adapt to a different climate.
Can you tell us like a bit about the genesis also of your curatorial role? I mean, when did it start? How did it take shape? And how is it currently also taking shape?
Yeah, maybe let me start a little bit about the methodology. One of the things we tried is actually to incorporate as much as possible a lot of bottom-up into a process that usually is quite top down. You know, when you are the director of the Biennale, what you're doing, you're deciding whom to invite, and then you, in a top down way, that do a list of names, and then the Biennale would invite them. You know, that's how the international exhibition comes together. And here what we tried in different ways was also to have many channels to hear voices in a more bottom up way. A key thing there was something we called the call for ideas last summer. In the call for ideas, we opened up and allowed everybody to send ideas, proposals for the Biennale. This was both daunting and extremely rewarding. It was daunting because we ended up having to reply to thousands and thousands of emails in order to follow up with everybody. But also very rewarding because I think we were able to find voices, some voices that otherwise we would not have been able to discover. You know, think about somebody maybe just out of university from the other side of the world and who submitted a proposal, and that turned out to be a very good proposal then included into the exhibition. There's a few additional things. Also, when each of us from the curatorial team was traveling across the world, we tried not to add additional travel for the Biennale, but every time we were traveling somewhere, we did also a number of salons. And, we engage with, hundreds of people in salons, meeting local architects, designers, but also people from other disciplines and just listening to them. And that really helped both at the very beginning to find and sharpen the theme, but also during the exhibition about finding, again, new voices and, listening to how people would interpret the theme. And then finally, a last thing about this kind of more bottom-up approach dealt also with the national participations. Now, usually the director doesn't have much to do with national participation. National participation, you've got all the different countries bringing to Venice usually beautiful pavilions, but in a non very coordinated way. Sometimes when you go through the national participation, it's a bit like a hodgepodge, because themes change a lot, scale and theme and so on. And so this year we actually were inspired very much by what Rem Koolhaas did back in 2014 when he ran the Venice Biennale. And at the time, he tried to harmonize the different voices. What he did at the time was, pose a precise question about modernism and let national participations build on that question. And so here in a similar way, we try to harmonize all the different voices from the national pavilions. But we did it more in a bottom-up way. In a bottom-up way, again, by meeting together with the national pavilions, we met a number of times, and just everybody was sharing their ideas, the ideas on the topic One Place, One Solution, so bringing ideas from all over the world about adaptation. And a little bit later, people got excited by listening to each other and starting themes started resonating. You see all this kind of enrichment that happened because of a conversation, again, happening in a bottom-up way among all the national participations. So these are just a few examples how what we tried to do was really to open up the curatorial process and add to what is normally a very top-down process as much bottom-up as we could.
So I think that is pretty much speaking towards the collective intelligence, I guess, or to the collective also wisdom. I really kind of like that. That resonates a lot with me, to just kind of listen to people, to grassroots developments potentially, and to a much broader range than the usual suspects. And I mean,
It is. You're right. You're right. It resonates with that. And also, if it resonates, we hope it will continue to resonate. Usually, Biennale, you got two or three conferences called meetings in architecture, and usually are architects talking to architects. So what we decided to do is take the little budget we had for that and actually use it to help others to come to Venice and have conversations. And this will happen in the Arsenale in a project we call the Speaker's Corner. And there almost, every day, many times a week, there will be different type of conversation, exactly what you were saying about continuing this idea of bringing different communities together in talking about the theme of the Biennale.
I think that's really fantastic. And I mean, Carlo, you are engaged into academic institutions, into kind of professional life with the office that you run and with the projects. What did surprise you during that journey? Was there one example that you can give where you felt, hey, what a fantastic thought or what a fantastic solution? Is there anything that stands out?
It would be difficult to pick one project or something in particular. You will see it. Maybe let me tell you about something that came in an accidental way. And I remember as soon as we started talking with the team at the Biennale, one of the things they told me was, well, we got a big problem. And the problem is that, as you might know, the Biennale usually is in two places. It's at the Arsenale, this beautiful building. You know, it was at the time one of the biggest factories in the world where, you know, boats were made in the Republic of Venice. And then you got the Giardini with the Central Pavilion. And this year, Giardini's Central Pavilion is being refurbished, so we don't have that space. Almost half of the exhibition space is not available. And I remember, you know, at the beginning, this was presented as a big problem, but little by little, we started thinking about it, and it turned out to be a great opportunity. And the opportunity was, what about if we turn Venice itself into a place where people, and I say people, I mean, you know, interdisciplinary teams with architects, designers, but also with scientists and social scientists, sociologists, and so on, and many others. You know, they can we can develop projects in order to use Venice as a living lab. And I think for me that has been, that was totally unexpected at the time, but has become something quite special about the Biennale, this year. I think there's something beautiful in the fact that Venice, one of the most fragile cities, when we think about adapting to a changing climate or adapting to mass tourism or responding, let's say, to mass tourism, then, you know, could become a lab to develop ideas, solutions, and those solutions can benefit Venice, but also perhaps inspire other cities around the world. So I thought something totally unexpected was this idea of then, because of lacking the Central Pavilion, to use Venice itself as a venue. And I'm very excited to see how what will happen when the Biennale itself will be not only in the two classical sites, but you see pieces of the Biennale in the middle of Venice, even in Piazza San Marco, you have one of the projects in the middle of the piazza, engaging audiences that normally might not even be going all the way to Giardini or Arsenale.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it also somehow entails that kind of the access from, again, various different communities, even or potentially especially outside of the architecture and design bubble, the access to the theme and to the exhibition pieces itself. And as you rightly say, Venice itself kind of represents potentially one of the most prominent examples of architecture that is so dramatically affected by the climate crisis. Can we expand a bit
on Marty, maybe just... Yeah. Because you mentioned bubbles, actually one of the projects that's called Bursting Bubble is a project that was proposed through the Call for Ideas, we said before, by Stefan Petermann. You might know Stefan, who is now the director of Volume magazine in the Netherlands. And this kind of about Bursting Bubble is really about that. And he will do a number of things, kind of short circuits of how to make sure different bubbles sometimes don't communicate, you know, those who go to the Biennale with other communities in Venice, how they can be exposed in different ways to this. One of my favorite is like he was looking into using vending machines for souvenirs in Venice. You know, usually people who buy souvenirs in Venice are not the same people as going to the Biennale, but selling them beautifully designed super Dutch souvenirs, again, to create short circuits between different audiences.
Yeah, that's really, really exciting.
Werbung. Werde Teil der internationalen Architekturwelt. Die Iconic Awards 2025 sind die Auszeichnung für Architektur, Interior Design und innovative Produkte. Nutze deine Chance auf mehr Sichtbarkeit und mach mit auf iconic-awards.com. Werbung Ende.
Carlo, the theme of intelligence, we touched on it, and it's clear that you kind of put also intelligent solutions at the heart that could potentially promote adaptability and resourcefulness. Can you expand a bit on that? What an intelligent solution could look like?
I probably wouldn't talk about intelligent solutions per se. Sometimes, you know, solution, and also probably not about solution. We're talking about designs sometimes are successful, sometimes are not. It's really very similar to what happens in nature, where you try something and get feedback loops to see how things work. The key thing is really how to leverage, when we say different type of intelligence, you know, we're talking about the intelligence of nature, learning from nature, from natural materials. There's a lot of beautiful experiments in architecture today. We'll see them at the Biennale, people doing this, but also the artificial is not only just AI, the artificial is about different type of technologies and networks, how they can help us shape in a different way the built environment, and of course a collective, how we can learn from each other, how we've been learning from each other for thousands of years. The vernacular evolving in this way, and how we can keep on, again, having similar feedback loops in the way we shape the built environment. So the idea is more about how we can leverage all the different dimensions, not only one dimension, not only the very narrow focus on technologies or something else, but how we can leverage in a holistic way different type of intelligence, again, to face the most important challenge today, adapting to, I would say, an altered planet. You know, alter because of climate and a number of other dimensions. And so in bringing together this intelligence, also you get this very rich, very heterogeneous type of approach and people from different disciplines, from different age groups. So I'm very excited about the fact, you know, you've got teams where you've got very young students with very established architects, with Pulitzer Prize winners or several Nobel Prize winners part of the exhibition, as well as people coming from many other fields, from art, from fashion, from very practical disciplines, in order to, again, to face and to help develop ideas for the built environment.
Speaking of challenges, Carlo, we are also facing like resource scarcity. We are facing the climate crisis that is also related to the expansive use of materials that are part of our global supply chains and all that. I know, and you know, that the theme of circular economy is also an inherent part of the concept. What's your current take on it? It obviously goes beyond resource efficiency and waste reduction. Can you expand a bit on that?
Yes, with pleasure. Yeah, as you mentioned, the circularity will be at the core of the Binare. We developed together with Ellen MacArthur and her foundation, and also with Arup, what we call the Circularity Manifesto. It was presented last year in New York and New York Climate Week. But something that bothered me always, you know, when doing temporary events can be Biennales, can be in design weeks, can be the Olympics, the expos. You know, we've been engaging in a lot of similar events. And usually the exciting thing about such events is that you're building something only for weeks or months, so you can be more experimental. What always bothered me is that you build something beautiful, a lot of materials then go to landfill. And so what we wanted to do here is start thinking about how we can make temporary event more sustainable. In this kind of circular manifesto, it's something we developed for the Biennale. We couldn't impose it on everybody, as you know, the people you invited, then, you know, they will make their own decisions. But you can really say we really strongly encourage you to follow it. And somehow I want to walk the talk. And for what we could do here, for instance, I'll tell you one. Usually in the Biennale, people use a lot of plasterboard, and that goes to landfill at the end of the Biennale. What we did this year is use everything with panels from boards by a very interesting company. It takes all furniture, shreds it, and then turns it into boards for making new furniture. And so we're using basically most of the, in terms of exhibition design, most of it is done using this kind of boards, and then at the end of the Biennale, they would be chipped again and turned into other furniture. So they're already recycled at the beginning, they would be recycled in the end. And there's a bunch of other things. Again, probably not everything would be perfect because you don't have, as a curator, as a director, control on all the different projects. But for what we could, we tried to push in this direction. And hopefully the manifesto is something that could inspire other temporary events, again, from Olympics to expos and similar.
I mean, as you rightly say, it is a temporary element that puts, I guess, a special pressure on using resources and materials in a more thoughtful way. So I really hear what you're saying. And what I also liked and what resonates with me is that it doesn't have to be perfect, as you rightly say, because I mean, if we would take circular economy or circular design really literate, it's almost impossible at the moment, because there are certain design traditions and procurement logics and the supply side. Are there more kind of like local elements? I remember there were also discussions, because circular economy must also be usually a local economy. Are there any kind of further examples where you felt, hey, we also engaged the local supply side in a different way compared to other biennales?
You're right. The circularity needs to connect both with the local, both in terms of production, but also in terms of recycling. I mean, you could have something that theoretically can be recycled, but then if you don't have the facilities locally. So there's a couple of projects looking at that. There's many projects in the middle of the biennale. We'll have something we call that you can think about as a material bank. In there, you will see a lot of materials, again, natural, artificial materials, but a lot of them starting from the lagoon, starting from the local conditions. This is totally part of the approach. I wanted to add to what you were saying before, you know, in focusing on temporary, we didn't want to say that, you know, circularity is vital as well when you're building house for 50 or 100 years, but it's even more extreme on contemporary things because there everything is going to landfill. And also, so we wanted to walk the talk. So what we tried to do is, can we start ourselves to experiment a little bit with where we have choices? We made circular choices and we try to encourage everybody also with the national participation to do so.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also clear that within and also outside of the design community, the Biennale has a massive impact and in that sense, a massive opportunity to influence local, regional, but also global communities towards adopting more sustainable practices, more innovative materials, system solutions. So let's maybe zoom out a bit, Carlo, also kind of beyond the Biennale and reflecting a bit on your overall professional perspective. If we look at like cities, urban spaces at large, what's your overall vision for urban spaces, smart cities, the role of technology? How is that changing? How has that evolved over time? If you want to make the connection back to the Biennale, can we take that as a lens now for future developments?
First of all, let me say a couple of things. One is that I hate the word smart cities. Our lab at MIT is called Sensible City Lab. You know, some people at the very beginning, maybe like 10 or 20 years in our work, you know, saw a lot of the technological component, which is true, it was there. But for us, the important thing was more biology. If you want, even, I remember in 2006 at the Biennale by Ricky Burdett, so now 20 years ago, for the first time in the world, we looked at networks, cell phone networks, and how networks can help us to describe a city as a living organism. You know, that was certainly a technological approach, but technology for us was only a way to look at a city like a living organism, to go back to that dream by Ildefonso Cerdà, the father of modern Barcelona, who in the second half of the 19th century was dreaming about a day when planning, thanks to new types of data, could become a different type of discipline. Again, I'm saying these two things to say that the technology side for us is not a goal, it's a way, it's a mean in order to achieve something. Going back to the theme we were saying before, for instance, in terms of circularity, there's a beautiful project in the Biennale. It's by a team from Ukraine. And what they're doing is actually using AI in order to classify all the rubble following bombing in Ukraine and see what could be reused. Somehow, when you got a lot of rubble, a lot of after bombing, you know, you want to start from the materials you're there, but you need to classify them. And AI works very well. Visual AI, you take images, footage, you know, video of the rubble, and you use it as a first pass to classify things so that, again, you can reuse what you got there instead of throwing everything to landfill and having to bring in new material. So these are some examples of how we think that technology can help us. But the goal is always a different one. In this case, in the case of the Biennale, we'll see, again, how cities, a living organism, can adapt better to changing climate.
It completely resonates. I mean, we also see technology more as an enabler and not as the answer. That's clear. At the same time, it can help, as you said, also with respect to the example in Ukraine, it can help addressing a certain complexity that we currently see and that we are facing, especially in a, let's say, circular city where, I don't know, every building is a material bank and you want to understand what type of volumes and qualities you have that you can use in the future. So I think this is where technology can fill a certain gap. But yes, I think the question is, what is really creating like value to the life of people in cities that is probably more related to nature in cities, for instance? What's your overall vision, and again, what type of examples can we see in Venice as to how nature and cities can be combined in a much more intuitive way that goes beyond, I don't know, green roofs and green facades?
Many different examples from this point of view. Let me tell you one of the important things, for instance, when you look at rising temperatures. There, no doubt we're seeing extreme temperatures in different parts of the world. There's urban heat island, but also extreme temperature because of climate change. In our office in Rio de Janeiro a few months ago, it was around 45 Celsius plus a lot of humidity that made it feel like 65 Celsius. And you know, under those conditions, none of us could survive very long outside at that temperature. And then when you're looking at that, then green in nature can provide, can help a lot. You know, we cannot air condition our cities Also, when you're air conditioning something, you're generating and you're throwing away a lot of heat somewhere else. It's what happens during the summer. You know, people are in their car, maybe a refrigerated car, but outside is even worse because all of the heat is going outside is shared with the environment. So one of the few things we can do with extreme temperatures is actually to start having more green in our cities. And one of my favorite projects, there's a few favorite projects that have been added that really look at this dimension. There's also a project we have been involved that actually looks at AI and how with AI we can classify all the trees in a city and look at their cooling power. So somehow starting to look at how different type of green has a different effect on the local microclimate, and again, how we can guide design using more data from what is already there in our cities.
That's fantastic. That also reminds me on one of kind of my first project when I started my career that looked into green facades and the cooling effects. And we were looking at certain streetscapes in cities internationally. And we also proved together with the university, like the cooling effects that are of course evident. And it's kind of easy to also sense that when you're walking through a park. It's interesting. Berlin just developed a new, or actually kind of refurbished a large urban space, and it was completely clad in stone. There's not a single plant on that space, if you like. And it's incredible to see that in year 2025, that city still design with old patterns in mind, but that's just a side comment.
But what you were saying is very interesting about, you know, because the mechanism is usually evapotranspiration. And so by doing that, you want to be as porous as possible. It's about letting water go into the soil. And then trees, by doing evapotranspiration, can cool the environment. The interesting thing that nobody knows yet, you know, it's you mentioned this process in, like you were talking about in the facade, is known and understood. But for instance, what we don't know yet is how different species have different effects on the microclimate. For instance, what we're seeing is Dubai is planting a lot of palm trees. But actually they are, from that point of view, mitigating extreme temperatures. They're some of the most inefficient trees in terms of cooling the environment. And so I think hopefully out of some of the projects that have been added that we'll see, some more knowledge can be developed to help us again design and build better cities and better cities and better squares.
I'd like to discuss a bit the role of architects in that context, because I guess you'll agree that we see that role is evolving in society. The question is, what's the opportunity for architects to help solving some of those challenges that we touched on? What's the social impact of architectural projects, and why are kind of those community engagements so important? You touched a bit on that, but can you expand a bit?
You know, what comes to mind are the words of the great Buckminster Fuller: utopia and oblivion. And I think that this could be a utopia and oblivion moment for all of us. You know, if architecture will keep on looking at minor issues, at dealing with beautifying different objects, you know, with not really crucial questions of the built environment, that it would be oblivion. But if we really start focusing on key issues such as adaptation to a changing climate, adaptation to different types of social issues, then architecture can be at the center of it. And together with other disciplines, one of the things we see in Venice is actually this theme where really the focus on the built environment, so it's, if you want, on the architectural side, in a traditional sense of the work, but actually with other disciplines helping. And so if we are able to do it, then architecture can be at the center and the architect can play a role like an orchestrator for probably what we need. The main focus we have for the next few decades is not about, especially in Europe, in the United States, in good chunks of Asia, it's not about building cities for more people. It's about fixing what we already have.
That's a very powerful message. So would you say that architects have a different responsibility now in the context of these global challenges, and the responsibility to combine much more diverse skills, perspectives, and all that goes far beyond of designing for a specific local context?
Well, I would say we could have the central role, and I hope that we'll be able to discuss it in Venice, and you know, this will also come out of the exhibition. So this role, the role we could play, is a central role. But to do it, we need to, first of all, change the focus, as we were saying, probably also change the methodology. Traditionally, architecture was seen as, you know, the architect as a solitary hero, proposing his ideas and sometimes imposing his ideas on society. He is about how can we do it in a much more collaborative way? Again, can we do it as more as proposals and let the people decide what type of developments, what type of cities they want to live in? So a slightly different approach versus what we saw in the 20th century. And then finally, also probably changing authorship. One of the things we try to do at the Biennale is actually, we try to do at the Biennale this year, change authorship. Usually in architecture, you got the architect and a number of consultants. Here we invited and list everybody in the same way, people from different disciplines, in a similar way to what happens in academia. When you write a paper, then everybody's listed. You know, you specify the contribution, but it's a much more inclusive way to make sure that every contribution is acknowledged and that everybody is part of the team. So somehow, I think, going back to your question, yes, architecture can be at the center, should be at the center tomorrow. But to do that, we need to make significant changes, both in the focus and in the way we operate on a daily basis.
Again, I think that resonates a lot. In that sense, I think it is changing away from, I don't know, from the genius that is kind of sitting at the desk and kind of designing one piece of architecture towards a much more serving role, if you like, a facilitator that facilitates different themes and perspectives, and that is kind of ideally also deeply embedded into local communities, has deep knowledge about the materials, the techniques, the systems. I think that's a very also strong closing, Carlo. Thanks a lot. A fantastic conversation. I tried to summarize a couple of things also in response to the question that we had in the beginning, whether architects can shape an intelligent and resilient future. So what I got out of the conversation, and I think you were very clear that architects and designers definitely hold a collective responsibility to shape an intelligent, resilient, and sustainable future. How? By designing with deep awareness of the environmental impact of the social equity and cultural relevance. What I also got out is that there is an evolving role that extends far beyond just creating buildings, of course, or cities, but it's to become stewards of the built environment, championing adaptive, inclusive, and regenerative solutions that, I guess, serve both the people and the planet. And lastly, as collaborators and visionaries, architects and designers could lead the way in integrating innovation with responsibility to meet the complex challenges of our time. So again, Carlo, thanks a lot for the conversation. Looking forward to meeting you during the Biennale. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you. And I hope to see you and everybody in Venice starting on the 10th of May.
The Design Perspectives podcast is a production of the German Design Council.
We would be delighted if you would subscribe to Design Perspectives. If you have any question, comments, or criticism, you can just send us an email to podcast@gdc.de. Thanks for listening.